Columbia, but actually Fulton, right? To see all of you and visit all of you, we've been able to have a nice few days with our kids and grandkids, and just, again, another wonderful Thanksgiving meal, actually several, and probably be eating on that for several days. But anyway, enjoying the time we have here. So I was listening to Mr. DeGagne. I thought, well, he could have just taken my notes and just kept going for the next hour. Falls in line with a lot what I'm going to say, although I'm going from a different slant, I guess a different way that I want to talk about this, because, you know, as we come to, this is November 28th, it's already the end of the year. I mean, we have December to go through. And it's hard to believe that we're already at the end of this year, isn't it? I tend to every year look back at my year to see where I've been. Not in states and things like that. I mean, not that way, but is where I've been in my spiritual life. And this, towards the end of the year, is a good time, I feel, in my life to reflect on what I've done, what I've accomplished. If you are like me, I set goals for my life. There's things I want to do. There's things I want to change in myself, even though I'm very perfect, as my wife says. She said imperfect. I'm sorry. I got that word wrong. But anyway, there's things I like to look at. There's things I want to look at my life. I wanted to dig deep into myself and say, where did I succeed in my life? Where did I fail in my life this year? And, you know, we live in a society that really thrives on illusions. There's plenty of, I don't get to watch a lot of television, so I can't even name you any programs right now, but there are a lot of programs and movies about illusion, right? Illusions that are out there. And if you were to ask somebody that doesn't have God's truth, doesn't know God's truth, they would probably, in a way, say to you, what is reality anyway? What is it? And you and I, thankfully, being called by God, know what the reality is. But this self-deception, this illusion that is in the world today, really has society at a loss. Because it includes things like how we perceive ourselves. You know, how do you perceive yourself? How do you perceive those around us, those around you, with regard to their spiritual character? How does God know what we are really? What we're really like? And he knows, I mean, but how does he know what we're really like? And how does he let us know that we stand in relationship to him? And so the answer and the title of the sermon today is by constantly, and you can just say, testing our spiritual character. So that's what this sermon is on today, and this sermon came from really me looking at myself, testing my spiritual character to where what I've done this year, what I've done with my life, how I've accomplished the things I wanted to accomplish. And did I accomplish those things? Or was it an illusion? Was my life an illusion? And so ask yourselves, am I living an illusion? Do I see myself as I really am? And sometimes those are hard questions to ask. Those are hard things to do because looking at yourself isn't easy. And I'm talking about deep in within yourself, not just the reflection you see in the mirror. I like looking at myself, actually. You know, I think I'm pretty good looking. But, all kidding aside, it's hard to see yourself. It's hard to admit who you are. And that's what I want to do at the end of the year, and that's hopefully this sermon is about doing that. Testing the spiritual character, who you are. And that means reflecting deep within inside yourself, admitting what you are, who you are, and willing to make changes. Because isn't that what life is about, right? Making changes in the godly way, moving in a godly direction. And so that's what this sermon I want to do, is to make this a positive sermon. It's not one, hopefully, it's not going to beat you over the head. This is something hopefully for you to look at, to think about, as we continue on towards this next year that's coming. Things that maybe you can set goals with, that you can have a checklist, maybe the things that you want to accomplish that you can accomplish. And I'm talking spiritually in your spiritual lives. Maybe it's just getting over something, overcoming a fault, overcoming whatever it is. And, you know, as with me, I'm sure everybody has those things that you have to overcome. You know, when people look at you, do they see who you really are? You know, that's another one of those questions is, you know, if we have Christ within us, if we have Christ's Spirit, right, God the Father's Spirit within us, should we not emulate Jesus Christ and God the Father? Is that what people see? And that's what I ask myself. Is that what people see when they look at me? When they look how I act, how I treat people, how I talk? And I can say over the year, no, there's times where it hasn't been. And that's something that I work on and want to work on. Because if they don't see that, are we just making a well-orchestrated facade? Again, an illusion. Is it something that we are in front of people, but we aren't when we're other places? And so we have to become so, you know, some may have become so good at their illusions that even we are deceived. No, that's something that I look at as me being a pastor. Have I ever acted in a way and given an illusion of this is who I am and then lived a totally different life? Because we know all have sinned. We know that. We understand that. Yet some seem to think that they are sinless, totally without that guilt, totally without those problems, those things happening in our lives. You don't need to turn there, but in John 1, chapter 1, verse 8, it says, if we say that we have no sin, we deceive ourselves. And it says the truth is not in us. Is that what we see? Are we deceived? You know, one of the things I think about was, you know, I can come to church every Sabbath. I can keep the Sabbath day. I can keep the holy days. I can keep God's commandments. I can keep his statutes and judgments. But that can be an illusion. Why? Because if we're not living it, it is an illusion. You have to live that way of life. That's what God expects of us. And if we're not doing that, we are living an illusion, even in the church. And so that's, again, something that I look at in myself, in my life. And look at me. Let's turn over to 1 Corinthians chapter 3. 1 Corinthians chapter 3. The Apostle Paul here warns us not to be deceived into thinking that the wisdom of this human age that we live in is sufficient for obtaining salvation and for building up the church. And if we think ourselves as wise, you know, and there's times that I've probably thought myself as wise as far as the world standards, we have to renounce that dependence on the wisdom, again, the wisdom of this world, so that we are able to receive God's wisdom, right? That's what we're asking is, God, give me your wisdom. Give me the understanding. And so the two forms of wisdom, the wisdom of this world and wisdom of God, they don't mix, do they? They don't mix. Here in 1 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 18. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 18. Says, let no one deceive himself. If anyone among you seems to be wise in this age, let him become a fool that he may become wise. For the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God. For it is written, he catches the wise in their own craftiness. So their own deceit, their own illusions. And again, the Lord knows the thoughts of the wise, that they are futile. So in one way or another, we may become skilled illusionists. But our lives were not meant to be fake. Our lives were not meant to be unreal. Our lives were meant to be genuine. And if we consider ourselves to be true Christians, which again, that word is thrown around a lot, is, you know, they're a Christian, I'm a Christian. Well, if you're not following Christ, you're not a Christian. That's the really way it is. Christian is, there's a title to that. There's things that you do to be called a Christian. Just because you keep the Sabbath day doesn't actually mean you're a Christian. I mean, that's one of the things, right? That's one thing that you can do. But it says you follow Jesus Christ, Christ-like. And so if we consider ourselves to be true Christians, our lives, as you know, have vital purpose. We all have a vital purpose. You're here because God called you. There's purpose in your lives. There's purpose for you, and it must be used for that purpose. And we all know what that purpose is. That purpose is to build character, similar to the same character that Jesus Christ has. If Christian's life is a time of reality building, right? If our lives as Christians is a time of reality building, then it can't be an illusion. It can't be something fake. God has promised to rebuild us. God is rebuilding us through this time that we have on this earth until we have this holy, righteous character, right? His character, God the Father's character. And so he's building us through this time to get that character, to build ourselves. And his whole goal is to help us become what? Perfect. A perfect man, a perfect woman, with the what? The measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. Not just a convincing illusion, but genuine reality. You know, I heard the phrase before, you know, are you the genuine article? Well, am I? I think about myself when I'm talking about that. I'm not saying that to any of you. Am I the genuine article? You know, throughout history, whole cities, when we look at it, whole cities have tried to portray the illusion of a modern, you call it tolerant and advanced people. And in reality, they've come to represent what? They've come to represent, through their actions, cities of perversion. And during the time of the apostles, Corinth was one of those cities. You were probably thinking of Sodom and Gomorrah, weren't you? But Corinth was also one of those cities. Corinth was a seaport, as you know. And being a seaport, because of its position, they had a lot of people coming in for trading. And of course, a lot of people coming in, the nation converged, and all these cities mingled together. All these different philosophies, all these different ideas, worldly ideas. And therefore, it became an extremely liberal city with a very liberal and tolerant approach to life. And so you all probably heard the phrase, to Corinthianize. Maybe you haven't, but that's a term that was used. To Corinthianize became a synonym of lifestyle of wickedness during that time, of living a life that wasn't pleasing to God. Well, let's turn ahead just a couple chapters to 1 Corinthians chapter 5. 1 Corinthians chapter 5, we're going to begin in verse 2. 1 Corinthians 5, verse 2. Here Paul wrote really a stern letter to the Corinthians, to the brethren there. And he was horrified at this time that God's chosen people, again, here in Corinth, had become so tolerant of a situation that would have appalled a normal, decent, unconverted people somewhere else, would have appalled them. And Paul credits their intellectual vanity of thinking too highly of themselves. And that is, they knew better. They knew better than Paul. They knew better than God. And they relied on themselves. 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 1. 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 1. It is actually reported that there is sexual immorality among you, and such sexual immorality as is not even named among the Gentiles, that a man has his father's wife, and you are puffed up and have not rather mourned, that he who has done this deed might have been taken away from among you. So not only mourned for the atrocities that this man did, but mourned for him You know, you don't hate a person for their sin, do you? We are taught that. You don't hate somebody for what they've done. You hate the action. So they should have mourned for him as well. And that's what it's telling us here. So Paul confronted them. He looked at them and told them that their tolerant attitudes towards serious sin, again, this was a serious sin. And this hypothetical, I guess you could say, illusion, hypocritical. Hypocritical illusion that they portrayed by being Christians in their Christianity. And he commanded them to disfellowship the sinning person, didn't he? The sinning member, to take them out of the church until the time that he learned the lesson, that he learned to repent of his wicked ways. And that the sin, that sinful member was no longer portraying the illusion of Christianity. You know, this is not Paul just being prudish. Right? It's not being prudish. He knew that if that lackadaisical attitude, if that type of attitude was left in the church and it kept on and on, that it would spread, wouldn't it? It would go to every member. It would go to everyone there. And they would all be affected by that. A lot of you know the term, one rotten apple ruins the whole bushel, doesn't it? Well, so does sin. Right, we know that, we understand that, if it's tolerated in the congregation. And here in Corinth, Paul didn't want them to be spoiled. He didn't want that to affect them. Well, Paul used another analogy, one that was easily understood by the Corinthians, if we continue to read on in verse 6. Verse 6 says, "Your glorying is not good. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? Therefore, purge out the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, since you truly are unleavened. For indeed Christ, our Passover, was sacrificed for us. Therefore let us keep the feast, not with old leaven, nor with a leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth." So someone who is portraying an illusion of being a certain individual is not a person of sincerity and truth. Paul used that simple analogy here that we just read of this leavening agent, right? This leavening of bread, making sure us that sin can affect all Christian life. Just a little sin. And thankfully, the Corinthians finally got that. They understood what he was talking about. They got the point of what Paul was commanding them to do. And the man repented of his sins eventually. And then Paul reported that he could be restored back again to the congregation, to fellowship. And so, again, good came out of it. Good came out of the following God's commandments. Of course, it always does. We don't think so at times, as we heard, because of tests and trials. But it always does. But again, the Corinthians thought that they knew better. They thought that they understood better. And they had to go through some, again, tests and trials, didn't they? And by that testing and trials, it finally worked out. But you know what? It is also a test for Paul. If you think about that. It was a test for Paul because if he would uphold God's instruction dealing with this flagrant sin, God wanted to know that. Would he do that? You know, instead of giving the illusion of obeying God, would he stand up and tell them, "You're doing wrong. This is what you need to do." So it was also a test for Paul. Because God wanted to see his Christian character. Not just theirs. He wanted to see his Christian characters. And that's what God is looking and working with us for, is the completion of our character, of who we are. And so God is going to, as we heard, test us continually where we stand, if our beliefs are convictions or if they're preferences. And it also tells us where we're weak, doesn't it? You know, that's what I could have made a whole list. I should say I have made some lists. of where I'm weak, of what I need help in, of where I need to change. It also tells us, though, where we're strong. So testing is good, as we heard. I'll just reaffirm Mr. Gagagni's sermonette. Testing is good because it shows us where we are weak, shows us we are where we need to make improvements, and it's good for God. Why? Because God then can see where we stand in accordance with Him to help Him get to know us better. You know, when God tested Abraham, and we won't go through the whole story, but when He commanded him to offer his son Isaac, you all remember that story. Abraham's prompt and decisive decision to follow through showed his character, didn't it? And among all in that character was his faith. Sterling faith that he had. When on the earlier occasion, if you remember Abraham and Sarah, when they were found themselves sojourning in a potentially hostile area, hostile place, foreign land, their response of fear that promoted expediency was really manifested of their flawed character, wasn't it? And their moment of choice, the choice that they made. And so when you look at that moment, they failed the test. You know, I look back this last year, and there's several tests that I would know I was put in front of, and I failed them. Doesn't make me happy, but it just means I have more work to do. You know, when Jacob, if you remember Jacob, when he arrived at his uncle's home for an extended stay, his ability to establish himself during that time as an adult underwent really extensive training and testing, didn't it? His responses of what? Competitiveness. His responses of physical stamina, of perseverance, and of resilience demonstrated his character. How about you remember David and his sexual sin? How about Daniel for praying before end up in the lion's den? How about Ruth for remaining faithful to what? Her mother-in-law. And Esther for her nation. These were all tests that these people went through and either came out failed or passed. Failed or passed. And when they came out failed, guess what? Further testing had to be done. Further testing followed that. Jesus Christ's sterling character and personality emerges really from the Gospels as the way he handled himself. From the people that tested him, that posed tests to him, from the life that he lived during his public years on this earth. And those tests that he passed became excellent examples for all of us that we can do the same, that we can pass those tests. The test theme in the Bible is really so central to those stories that we read, those stories that we all maybe even talk to our and teach our kids, that I think it's virtually impossible for any of us to label all the tests. Really, to label those tests, because all of life's tests, all of life is a test every single day of our lives in everything that we do. You know, you think about it, look at the external world that we live in. Nature. I mean, we had a hurricane down in Orange Beach, didn't we? Those are tests, aren't they? They test us all the time. What about specific people? They're a test. Maybe the social environment that we live in, that's a test. Maybe our personal relationships with our spouses or our families is a test and identifies our loyalties, bringing our character traits out in that process. And sometimes they're not good personalities. You know, is there anything distinctive to the test pattern in the Bible? Anything distinctive Well, I think it is that the testing that transpires between God and his people. While it's really stated dozens of times, we go through the scriptures and look at it. Again, it's impossible to read those stories that are there in God's word without interpreting the events, which is testing spiritual character, or testing characters, I guess you could say, because they're all characters, that they're all from God. When you go through that, I mean, Mr. Gedagny brought up Job. Was God not involved in that? God was testing him, wasn't he? He allowed Satan to do all those terrible things, but God was testing him. Everything that we go through, God is allowing. He wants to see if we're going to pass those tests. You know, and we don't, okay, we failed. That means more tests are coming. And you may go through the same test over and over and over again because, you know what, he hasn't used the baseball bat on your head yet. I think about that with me. I just need to be cracked over the head a few times because I'm not learning. So I ask God, help me learn. Help me understand. Help me know. What is it you want me to learn from this? How can I change myself? And so that's what these continual tests are about. To determine our character, as he was doing in Corinth, and the people in the examples that we just looked at, their moral and spiritual standing. Turn ahead just a few chapters again here to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 1. First Corinthians chapter 10, verse 1 says, "Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud. All passed through the sea, all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink. For they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with most of them, God was not well pleased. For their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Now these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted." So they continued through all of the testing when they went through the wilderness. They were tested and tested and tested. And a lot of times we read they failed and they failed and they failed. They weren't learning, were they? They weren't, I believe, looking at themselves and say, what do I need to do to change? Because that wasn't their thought process. Their thought process was that I'm right and they're wrong. And so that testing continued. Verse 7 says, "And do not become adulterers as some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play. Nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did. And in one day, 23,000 fell." I mean, think about that. That many people failed the test. 23,000 fail. They failed. Verse 9. "Nor let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted, and were destroyed by serpents, nor complain, as some of them also complained and were destroyed by the destroyer." You know, I don't know that we often think of complaining as being a test. But do you know what it is? It is. Complaining is a test. We're being tested to see what our attitudes are. Is it always just, oh, that's unfair, and you know, this never works out for me, you know. Those are all tests. God is testing our spiritual character. How we're going to react, what we're going to say. Verse 11. "Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. No temptation or test," you can put in there, "has overtaken you except such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted or tested beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it." So that verse really comes out with two essential truths that we can see here. The first one is the testing that each person undergoes is unique. Your tests and my tests aren't the same. Your tests among yourselves aren't the same. They're unique, or they're not unique. Sorry, I've had that opposite. We have a lot of the same tests. Maybe not at the same time, but we go through some of the same testing in our lives. But it says, because it says they are common to men, common to man. So, you know, there's times where you think, what I'm going through is horrible because nobody else has gone through this. Well, then you look and see what some people are going through. And you think, wow, what I've got is pretty easy. Pretty simple. Well, the second essential truth there is God is not allowing us to be tested beyond our strength, beyond what you and I can handle. But with the test, we'll also provide, he says, a way of escape, a way to get out of that, and a way that you and I can endure it. So with those two things, we're able to handle any test that comes. Again, by God, because God is in full control. And that's what we have to understand. He's in control. Yes, this is our physical life. We're to be learning and growing, but God is in control. God is supposed to have He's supposed to be in the driver's seat. But we have to allow Him that chance. We have to give Him, I hate to say this, give Him the wheel. You know, sorry, that song comes to mind. Jesus, take the wheel. Sorry. But you have to allow Him to take the wheel. And you have to get in the passenger seat. You have to start doing what He's telling you and talking to you about and opening your mind to. You know, much the same way today we see the Corinthians were so busy demanding proof that God actually was speaking, or Christ was speaking through Paul. Right? They wanted proof of that. And they forgot that they ought to be examining themselves. They ought to be testing themselves. Let's turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 13. 2 Corinthians chapter 13. We'll begin in verse 5. 2 Corinthians chapter 13 and verse 5. So examine yourselves as to whether you are in the faith. And so I look at that to myself and I think, okay, the faith is keeping all the Sabbath, the Holy Day, everything else. But am I living that? That's the other part of it that we forget to see. Am I living that way of life? That's testing, examining yourself. Am I walking that walk? And it goes on, test yourselves. Do you not know yourselves that Jesus Christ is in you? Unless indeed you are disqualified. Or as the NIV has it says, lest you have failed. Unless you have failed the test. And it goes on, but I trust that you will know that we are not disqualified. Or we have not failed the test. Now I pray to God that you do no evil, not that we should appear approved, again, giving the illusion of being in God's church, but that you should do, again, an action, isn't it? That you should do. Remember, action equals character, and character equals action. That you should do what is honorable, though we may seem disqualified. So just attending services can be an illusion. It can be, if we allow it to be. If we're not living God's way of life, if we're not putting it in action. You know, the word here translated yourselves is in each case emphatic by position. There's no doubt that Paul, who he was talking to here. He is basically saying, do you know yourselves sufficiently enough? Have you looked into your life? Have you looked at yourself in the mirror to recognize that Christ lives within each of you, and therefore you are in the faith? by testing themselves, the Corinthians would avoid having God test them. Testing faith produces patience, and it produces perseverance. Whether it's God who is testing us, or whether it's we who are testing ourselves. I mean, I would rather test myself than have God test me. Because I wouldn't be as hard on myself, okay? I'll give it, be honest. But we are to test ourselves. We are to do those things. James chapter 1 and verse 2. James chapter 1 and verse 2. And here we come into a little bit of what Mr. DeGagny was talking about. James chapter 1, verse 2. My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. James explain that trials are reasons for rejoicing. Rejoicing because of the wholesome effects that they produce. Maybe we haven't thought it in that way, though. Trials do produce a waiting period, don't they? As Mr. DeGagny talked about, they are very joyous. What he went through was terrible. What they went through is terrible as husband and wife. But now they have great joy because of what? Their daughter that they would have never had. I'm saying, in their lives. So it creates great joy. You know, there may be difficulties that come from without, such as persecution. Right, we get that around us, and we'll get that around us more and more as years go on. Or they may be inner moral tests for each one of us, such as what? Temptations to sin. That outward trial, rather than being a reason for unhappiness, should really be a catalyst for pure joy. Because if God is in the driver's seat, he knows what the outcome is going to be. He is putting us down this path. And if we have faith and trust in him, it should be joyous, no matter what the outcome. That's hard for us as human beings. It's hard to go that, to put that in perspective, to put it into our minds, to understand this is what God's purpose is. And it's not merely, again, the coming of a single trial that is described here. James, he speaks of experience of trials of many kinds, of many sorts. You know, I'm sure everyone here in this building today can look back at the last year and see that there are many different trials and things that you've gone through. Things that have tested you, tested us as God's people. And sometimes they come at the same time. Sometimes they just pile on one another. And I know several who've been very overwhelmed by those trials and those tests. But the picture being described here is that being surrounded by all these trials of many kinds. And sometimes you can say the original Greek, when you look at it, talks about being of many colors. And the first thing I thought of was, well, isn't that something? I don't know about Missouri, but I know that all the other states have colors for COVID. Right? Green, yellow, orange, red, purple. You guys don't have that here, do you? Well, I know Utah, we have up to red. Colorado has up to purple now. They just added another. So it's trials. Aren't they all trials? Each color is a trial. Trials of many colors. I know Utah and Colorado are in the red right now. And so that means even in services, we have to wear masks. And in Colorado, you can only have two families together. No more than 10 people in two families, and if you have more and somebody catches you, it's a $1,000 fine. Red is a test. But I found that interesting that the original Greek uses colors. Well, in verse 3, the Greek word hypomonen is translated patience in the King James and in the New King James. But it is much more, it's a much more active, it's a much more forceful word than that, than just patience. And it speaks of really tenacity. It speaks of stick-to-itiveness. So patience does not quite really fully express it, does it? Of what we're talking about. You know, William Barclay, in his book, New Testament Words, explains this. He says, it is not the patience that passively endures. Instead, it is the quality that enables us to stand on our feet facing a storm. It is in struggling against difficulty and opposition that spiritual stamina is developed. So we see here the goal in verse 4 is that we may become spiritually mature, right? Spiritually complete is another word that's used for that. And again, the Greek word for perfect, you can look at it, it is complete, it is mature. And again, they use perfect there as explaining that. And so that word perfect that we're looking at here refers to maturity, refers to becoming spiritually mature in all that we do, in all that we portray that we are. Because Scripture does not indicate, at least I haven't seen it anywhere, it doesn't indicate that we will reach perfection in this physical life. Right? We aren't going to be perfect in this physical life. No chance. Ain't going to happen. But we can mature. Right? We can mature. And so patience and perseverance in facing trials, in facing these tests, develops maturity of character and a balance of the refinement and strengths needed as Christians and in our Christian lives. You know, an obvious reason I think that these trials should be considered catalysts for joy in our lives is that they are capable of developing patience, or some translations have perseverance. They put our faith to the test. And this experience produces what? A desired result for all of us in our lives. You know, the question answered by testing of faith is whether or not we have perseverance or whether or not we have patience. If it's genuine faith, if you and I have genuine faith, testing serves to develop faith's persistence. And by that, testing both God and ourselves, by God and ourselves, we see how dedicated we are to God. How dedicated are we really? Verse 4 goes on to tell us that patience and perseverance have a work to do. There's action involved, right? We talked about that. And this can be accomplished by only being persistent in the trials. If patience is to have its perfect work, or perseverance is to finish its work, faith must not falter or give up. Trials enable us to improve. To improve and prove our faith. In Romans chapter 4, if you want to begin turning there, Romans chapter 4, Paul uses again Abraham as an example of someone who grew strong in his faith as he went through the test of waiting 25 years for the birth of his son Isaac. Romans chapter 4, verse 16. Romans chapter 4, verse 16. Therefore, it is of faith that it might be according to grace, so that the promise might be sure to all the seed, not only to those who are of the law, but also to those who are of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all. As it is written, I have made you a father of many nations. in the presence of him who he believed, God, who gives life to the dead and calls those things which do not exist as though they did, who, contrary to hope, in hope believed, so that he became the father of the many nations according to what was spoken. So shall your descendants be. And not being weak in faith, he did not consider his own body already dead, since he was about 100 years old, right? And the deadness of Sarah's womb. He did not waver at the promise of God through unbelief, but was strengthened in faith, giving glory to God and being fully convinced that what he had promised, he was able to perform. And therefore, it was accounted him for righteousness. So we see the results of Abraham passing the test. The essence of Abraham's faith in this case that we read here was that he believed that God could make the impossible possible. He believed that. He had faith in that. And true faith is in God always triumphs in tests and trials. As long as we believe that everything depends on our efforts, we are bound to be pessimists. Because experience has taught me and taught the unforgiving lesson that our own efforts can achieve very little. You know, we all know, I by myself can do nothing. We produce very little on our own. And when we realize that it's not our efforts, that's God working through us and God working for us with his power, then we become optimists. Because we're bound to believe that with God, nothing is impossible. You know, I can do all things with Christ who strengthens me. Do you believe that? I do. I believe I can do all things. But we have to give that to God and let him do it. Let him work that through it. James continues the theme of patience and perseverance in James chapter 5. In the beginning verses, James, and if you want to begin turning there, you can, James chapter 5. But in the beginning there in those scriptures, James warned the rich of the coming judgment. And a little bit later on in there, he encouraged the oppressed to be patient. The exhortation concerning patience and perseverance in James 5 is built around three illustrations, as we'll look at. Three illustrations that he talks about here. The farmer, verses 7 through 9. Then he talks about the prophets in verse 10. And then he talks about Job in verse 11. So James chapter 5, and we'll begin in verse 7. James chapter 5 and verse 7. It says, therefore, be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, waiting patiently for it until it receives the early and latter rains. You also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Do not grumble against one another. Brethren, lest you be condemned. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. So there's an area today that we're being tested in. And again, we're being tested always, every day. But that is that grumbling that I talked about, the complaining that we have for each other at times. Verse 10, my brethren, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord as an example of suffering and patience. Indeed, we count them blessed who endure. You have heard the perseverance of Job and seen the end intended by the Lord, that the Lord is very compassionate and merciful. Well, that first illustration, as I mentioned, of patience and perseverance is that the farmer who waits patiently for the earlier and latter rains. Again, that was the fall and the spring. If you know anything back then, They had to have two rains. And they had to wait patiently for those rains, knowing this, the farmers were willing to wait patiently so that both the rains came so that they could provide the necessary sustenance that they needed, the crops that they needed, because that moisture was needed. And isn't that the same with our own character? We're waiting for those things to come in so we can build and have that character. The second illustration of patience and perseverance is that the prophets who spoke the name of the Lord, in their position, again, as his representatives, right, as Jesus Christ's representatives, they experienced what? Affliction, and responded to it with long suffering and patience. Although James refers to the prophets as a group, I think of Jeremiah. Jeremiah certainly stands out as one of those who endured mistreatment with patience and perseverance. He was put in the stocks, wasn't he? He was thrown into prison and lowered into a miry dungeon. Yet he persisted in his ministry without bitterness and without retaliation. That testing, I'm sure, was severe. But he came out and he passed the test. That third illustration of patience and perseverance is that of Job. And those who have endured are considered blessed, it says. You know, in verses 7 through 10, James' plea is for patience, which is the self-restraint that does not retaliate. But here in verse 11, James' plea is for perseverance. Right, to persevere, which perseverance is difficult under difficult circumstances. We often hear of the patience of Job. I think we've all heard that throughout the years, the patience of Job. But in the original Greek, it's more closely related to the perseverance of Job. And it's, I think, significant that James doesn't talk about or speak of Job's patience, since despite the popular phrase, the patience of Job, he hardly ever exemplified the quality of patience. Did he? However, he was an outstanding example of perseverance in some of the most trying situations. Most of all, and I think most of you are familiar with the story, he lost everything, didn't he? He lost everything, and yet when you come back to the story of him passing the test, what happened? I mean, God, you can tell right there, God doubled his flock. So what happened? With his perseverance, he passed the test, and he was blessed, as it talks about here. So testing produces character in each one of us. It shows where we stand with our character, with our relationship with God. And so if we were to sum up James chapter 5, verses 7 through 11, James urges us not to fight back, not to retaliate, but he says to exercise long-suffering and patience toward those who oppress us. And so he's calling for stout-hearted perseverance and the trying circumstances that confront us. This year has been one of the most trying years ever for everybody. Well, let's turn to Hebrews chapter 3. Hebrews chapter 3. You know, the book of Hebrews is addressed to Christians enduring persecution. And it likewise stresses endurance and holding fast as virtues required to pass a test. Hebrews chapter 3, verse 6. Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 6. But Christ is a son over his own house, whose house we are if we hold fast the confidence and the rejoicing of hope, the hope firm to the end. That's perseverance, isn't it? firm to the end, holding on, not wavering. You know, Jesus Christ knows our human condition. He understands that. It's not just something that he has heard about. We all know Jesus Christ became a man and was on this earth for a time. He knows what we go through. He understands that deeply. And he knows our weaknesses. And so we can approach him confidently, knowing he understands that he's there to help us. Turn ahead to chapter 4 here in Hebrews. Hebrews 4 and verse 14. Hebrews 4, verse 14, "Seeing then that we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted or tested as we are, yet without sin. Therefore, let us come boldly to the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in a time of need." You know, though Jesus Christ did not sin, we can't infer that life was easy for him. Many times we give in before the temptation. I don't know about you, but I have. Give in before the temptation has fully spent itself. But Christ did not do that. In a sense, he earned sinlessness as he gained victory after victory in his life as a man. In the constant battle of temptation throughout his life that he dealt with while he was on this earth. You know, the sinless one knows the force of temptation in a way that we who sin do not. Many times we give in before that temptation again. And so if we fail the test, if you and I fail the test that is set before us, or we do not overcome that temptation, we have not really and truly seen all the lessons to be learned from that temptation or that sin, that we have failed. And sometimes that's why we continue in that same test, that same trial, because we haven't passed it yet. We have failed it. And God is going to build that character in each one of us. That's his goal, isn't it? We will. And so that we're going to keep on being tested. We're going to keep on going through those trials. The goal of life itself is linked to the test theme found in James chapter 1 and verse 12. Which says, James 1 and verse 12 says, "Blessed is the man who endures temptation." Again, blessed. Because we endure with perseverance, with patience. For when he has been approved, meaning he has passed the test, he will receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him. You know, Romans chapter 5, let's turn over there, because it kind of catalogs a ladder type sequence of, I guess you could say, specific virtues produced by suffering through tests. Romans chapter 5 and verse 3. Romans chapter 5, beginning in verse 3. "And not only that, but we also glory in tribulations," again, or tests. We glory, knowing that tribulation produces perseverance, and perseverance, character, and character, hope. Now hope does not disappoint, because the love of God has been poured out in our hearts by the Holy Spirit, which was given for us. So trouble, trials, tests, produces perseverance. And that word Paul used for tribulation in verse 3 literally means pressure. That is exactly what we feel when we're being tested, isn't it? We feel this pressure. We feel that we can't get out of it. You know, even at the physical level, when we are going through school, and some of you younger ones are still going through school now, and we are tested. We are sitting there and we're laboring over the test. I used to do that all the time. Labor over the test that I had to take. Because it was an immense amount of pressure, because usually I didn't study. So that was my own fault, but it was still a lot of pressure. And it was unbearable sometimes. I mean, I can remember a time or two I even made myself sick over it. Where I just said, "Mom, I'm sick, I'm not going to school today." Gave me time to study. But it was an immense amount of pressure that we feel. And our spiritual lives are the same. What we go through spiritually, all kinds of things weigh heavily upon us. Desire, sorrow, persecution, unpopularity, loneliness. All that pressure produces what? Fortitude. And produces perseverance. Because you continue on in this life knowing God is there with you. And that Paul, the word Paul here uses for perseverance is the same word he used in James 1 and verse 3 and James chapter 5 and verse 11 that we read earlier. It means more than endurance. More than endurance. It means the Spirit can overcome the world. Christ overcame this world. You and I can do the same. We have God's Spirit within us. It means a spirit that does not passively endure, but that actively overcomes those trials, those situations, and the tribulations of life. You know, perseverance, Paul goes on to say perseverance produces what? Character. You know, the word he used here really is used to describe metal that has been passed through the fire. So that everything base has been purged out of it. Have you ever watched somebody forge something or at a foundry or doing metals or trying to pull out different types of metals? But it's used really to describe coinage. As we use the word sterling, right? As in sterling silver. When affliction is met with perseverance, out of the battle, we emerge stronger. We emerge purer. We emerge better and closer to God. There is much joy. When you think about that, it's joyous. It should be joyous to us to be going through these trials because it's getting us closer to God, making us closer to God. And Paul then goes on to character, and that character produces what? Hope. You know, two people can meet the same situation. And while two meet the same situation, it can drive the one to really despise and despair over it, while the other one triumphs over the same situation, the same trial. To one, it can be the end of hope. To the other, it can be a challenge to greatness. The difference corresponds to the difference in the character of the people, what they're made of. So if we have let ourselves become weak, and I look back through this year in my life, and there's times where I was weak. There was times where I was lazy in my spiritual life. If we allowed our circumstances to beat us, if we allowed ourselves to whine and grovel over our circumstances or under our affliction, then we have made ourselves such that when the challenge of crisis comes, we can lose hope. True Christians do not live illusions. We have the truth, and that truth really, from that truth comes reality. The way we perceive ourselves and those around us reflects our spiritual character. God spends our lives training us. Right? That's what we're in, is training. This is a training ground. God spends our lives training us to meet those challenges and get to know who we really are inside, who we really are in this physical body and what we're like. He lets us know where we stand in relationship to Him by constantly testing our spiritual character. And that final test of our character is our fruits. What are we producing? How we live, what we say, what we do, how we talk. It involves the totality of our being, doesn't it? I want to end today by reading Jesus Christ's admonition to the Church of Philadelphia. And this is recorded by the Apostle John. So let's go to Revelation chapter 3. The testing that faced the Philadelphians was not the same, as we know, as that facing the unbelieving earth dwellers at that time. We, as loyal disciples, will face one type of affliction or another, which will be different than what this world faces. If we pass the test as Christians, as God works with us, again, that's the only way we're going to pass these tests, is God working with us. When the world receives its greatest test, which is coming, we will be protected and preserved from that. Revelation chapter 3 and verse 10. Revelation chapter 3 and verse 10. Because you have kept my command to persevere, I will keep you from the hour of trial, which shall come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth. Behold, I come quickly. Hold fast. Persevere. Continue on to what you have, that no one may take your crown.